Welcome to another episode of The Short Code, a podcast of wit and wisdom from the students at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. Dr. David Oshinsky, PhD, is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Polio, An American Story. Drawing on the papers of Jonas Salk, Albert Sabin, and other key players, Dr. Oshinsky chronicles the campaign against polio and the race for a cure in the early 1950s. Dr. Oshinsky, who specializes in 20th century U.S. political and cultural history, taught for nearly 30 years at Rutgers University before moving to the University of Texas at Austin. We're fortunate to have him with us today at the UI Carver College of Medicine as we celebrate the 2012 Distinguished Mentor Award. Welcome, Dr. Oshinsky.
Thank you.
We're also here today with students Zixiang, Mbechi Arandu, and Natalie Ramirez. Welcome to you all. Natalie, I'm going to throw it to you to start off our discussion today.
Sure. So, Dr. Oshinsky, so you're coming from UT Austin, my alma mater. And what originally brought you, I think, to Iowa this time around?
Well, first, Natalie Hookem. I was invited here to give the lecture for the Mentor Project, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. I, to be perfectly honest, I have friends in Iowa City, good friends, but this is my first trip, and I'm really enjoying it.
It's fantastic. We're very happy to have you
here. Thank you.
So the other two students that we have here today, if you'd like to introduce your voices to the podcast, go right ahead.
Sure. My name is Z, and I'm a second year here at the College of Medicine.
And I'm Mbechi. I'm also a second year at the College of Medicine.
Great. So our goal today, I think, really is just to talk a little bit about this fantastic narrative, really, that you have here, Polio, An American Story, and how you went through that process, and then maybe just see where it goes from there.
Sure.
Well, I think in your book you mentioned a professor, Dan Wilson, who kind of catalyzed your interest in polio. Can you tell us what exactly he said that made you so interested in it?
I can. Dan is a polio survivor. Okay. He had a very, very serious case of polio as a young boy, I think in Wisconsin. And the very, very sad part about it was that Dan got polio literally in the months before the Salk vaccine came out. Mm. So he was right on the cusp. As Dan always says, I got the virus and my friends got the vaccine. And Dan was and still is a very, very courageous person. He has polio deeply debilitated him. And yet he has become one of the leading scholars of disability studies. And I met Dan at a number of conferences. I knew he was working on a book on polio, but rather than being a rival, rather than being his Albert Sabin to my Jonas Salk, Dan was extremely generous. And I think it was his deep commitment to polio that really spurred my interest in it.
What about personally, as a child growing up, what did you know about polio?
Well, I was born in 1944. The war was just about ending, although it was a year of very hard fighting ahead. And what that meant is that I grew up in the era before the polio vaccines. And the era before the polio vaccines was extremely frightening, meaning that polio would come every summer like the plague, and there was no cure for polio. There was no way to fight it off. There was no prevention, which meant that every summer, it would simply descend on communities. It hit very, very hard in Iowa, for example. And you would see absolute panic. Swimming pools would close because the belief was that it was transmitted through water. Children were not allowed in bowling alleys or movie theaters. They had to stay out of crowds. We were told to rest for long periods of time. I remember my mother telling me not to make any new friends, because I had the germs of my old friends, but why take the chance on finding a new friend with the polio virus? It got to the point in some towns where people wouldn't exchange money, they wouldn't shake hands. I remember having to take a polio test virtually every few days. Could I put my chin to my chest? Could I touch my toes? Oh, yeah. The slightest sign of a fever or a stiffness, would your mother in a panic would take you right to the doctor. And what I can most remember is coming back to school each September after polio summer and seeing kids in leg braces. You would see kids on crutches, and you would see the occasional empty desk, which meant that the child had not survived the summer. So for me, remembering polio is very personal. And I think for any young person before 1955, it's very, very personal. And I don't know if we have time, but I was one of the 2 million school children throughout the United States who took part in the Salk trials.
Oh, wow.
So it was, we were called polio pioneers. And, I don't have my badge anymore.
Did they give you a badge?
That's cool. They gave you a badge, and they gave you 3 injections. If you have seen the Marx Brothers A Day at the Races, it looks like the vet gave them to you. They're about yay long. And I remember the teacher saying to us, as we were ready to go out, you're polio pioneers. You're going to change the face of the earth for children for generations to come. Any questions? And every hand would go up, and it was, how much is this going to hurt?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
You know,
well, I mean, it brings up, I mean, you say that there was this, you know, big thing that you were given, this big award of some sort. But it was kind of a big deal. I mean, there was an element of risk.
I'll certainly talk about that in my lecture later today, but there were some control units as well. But basically, half the kids were given the real vaccine, and half the kids were given a look-alike placebo. And it was a double-blind study, since neither the caregiver nor the kid getting the shot knew who was getting the placebo or the real vaccine. And what is so extraordinary is that no one knew whether it was perfectly safe. Hmm. You know, there hadn't been that many clinical trials on humans. Nobody knew whether it worked. Jonas Salk really believed it did, and the March of Dimes did. And yet millions upon millions of American parents threw their kids to the front of the line. And that is amazing. Try to think of that happening today with the anti-vaccine movement and the like. And the reason is simply this. My mother and dad saw polio every year. They knew what polio did. They had a sense of risk versus reward that parents don't have today. You know, when a vaccine works, nothing happens, right? There is no disease. And therefore, a parent today might say, well, why does my kid need a polio shot? When's the last time anyone in the United States ever had polio? And the answer is, you stop vaccinating your kids, and you're going to find out.
Yeah, because polio has not been eradicated.
No, it's not certainly been eradicated. It's still around. Mm-hmm. It's particularly in Pakistan and Nigeria and Afghanistan. It is still around. To me, it was just extraordinary. It was just assumed that the vaccine was much less threatening than the disease. And therefore, of course, you gave your children this. And even though it wasn't, we were guinea pigs. But we were guinea pigs in a noble cause, and we were guinea pigs whose parents fully understood the risks unvaccinated children had every summer of their lives.
Mm-hmm. I think you write very well about how it was seen sort of as a patriotic kind of duty. You know, people really did come together, and a lot of those details were sort of put aside. Because you're right, I mean, these days, IRB approval, things like that. I mean, the expeditious nature of this trial in the past would never happen
never.
Today.
It would never. I once had a dean of a medical school say, if we had the same rules in line in the 1950s we have today, we'd still be waiting for the polio vaccine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No. It's that is absolutely true. And to some degree, it was a patriotic duty. But a lot of it was also, there was this incredible organization, which is still around but doing different things now, called the March of Dimes. Mm-hmm. And as I'll try to show this afternoon in my lecture, the March of Dimes really revolutionized philanthropy. And it also scared the hell out of the American public. It took a disease that was extremely frightening and that affected children, which makes it doubly frightening, but a disease that in raw numbers was never nearly as large as childhood cancer or other serious childhood diseases, and it made it America's disease. And that was quite extraordinary, and it did it through a marketing campaign, a new strategy for philanthropy that was extremely successful. Was there anything wrong with what the March of Dimes did? Well, if you talk to the American Cancer Society, there was a lot wrong with what they did because they took most of the charity dollar away from others. But the March of Dimes said, basically, we make two promises to the American people. first we'll find a vaccine to prevent polio, and they found two vaccines, the Sabin and the Salk vaccine. And the second is they said, we will provide free rehabilitation, regardless of income, for the child in any family who has polio. And they made good on that. Mm. So they kept their promises.
Mm. The thing that struck me in reading about polio and the history of the search was that, as you said, it in terms of raw numbers, it wasn't huge, but, you know, it got built up into this very scary thing, and, you know, ultimately that helped, you know, find the cure. But it struck me as being very similar to, you know, today's media cycle and, you know, how, you know, small, you know, problems are sort of built up into these bigger situations. I mean, is it analogous to that, or?
I think to some degree it is analogous, and particularly the strategies that organizations use, whether Post the Children, celebrities, mothers' marches, runs, you know, Susan Komen and the like. These all come from the March of Dimes. They're all part of the process that was part of the revolution the March of Dimes put into effect. But you have to understand as well that polio is a very visual disease. Mm. What do I mean by that? Someone has a heart condition and walks into the local Arby's, you can't tell.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Kid had polio, you knew it. Mm-hmm. You saw it, and you saw it everywhere. There may be 30, 40,000 cases a year, which is a lot built up over time. So you're going to see a lot of kids in very compromised positions. You're going to see them in pictures of iron lungs in hospitals. You're going to see them flat on their back. You're going to see them struggling to walk. You're going to see withered limbs. And I think it was the visual nature of polio to some degree that also moved this crusade forward.
So today, what would you say is kind of the polio equivalent? You know, I mean, you mentioned Susan G. Komen, but again, cancer is sort of a disease that you don't always see.
Yeah.
So I wonder, and I know that March of Dimes has kind of changed focus now.
It did.
Kind of more amorphous,
premature babies maternal health care. Well, you know, one of the problems was that the March of Dimes was this fundraising behemoth. But after two vaccines come out, virtually no kid gets polio anymore. They realized they're not going to be doing a whole lot of fundraising. So they had to change their outlook, and they try to find what's another childhood or issue involving small children. And they hit upon it. And they're very, very successful, and they do a good job. I think, Jerry's Kids would be one. Remember the Jerry Lewis telethons? That comes right out of the March of Dimes, which every year would have a poster child sort of throwing his crutches down, walking into the sunshine, saying, you give me your dime and I will walk again. All these celebrities who now take part in these galas for charity, it all comes out of the March of Dimes, which used everyone from Joe DiMaggio to Marilyn Monroe to, you know, Bob Hope and Bing Crosby and Grace Kelly, because they wanted to be associated with helping children. It was good for America, and it was good for their careers. So I think it's hard to pick one disease and say this is the equivalent. I don't think there is an equivalent today in terms of ratcheting up a national crusade for a single disease. I mean, that, to me, that's the genius of polio, which may not be repeated again. And I think some of it is, excuse me, that when the March of Dimes first started, there was no government funding for anything in terms of medicine. It was basically everything had to be done through the March of Dimes. So your dime really mattered. You know, today, people are paying taxes. There's the NIH, there's the CDC, there's the World Health Organization. So they see all of these bureaucracies being formed to fight disease, and they take a step back and say, well, I pay my taxes. What else do I need to do?
Right.
In the polio days, mothers and dads knew what they needed to do. They needed to raise money. Of course, it was going to come from no other source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, though, I mean, today, most people, you know, in medicine or the sciences in general will tell you and know well that grant funding is absurdly difficult to get, you know.
It is.
Basic science research is nearly impossible to do these days.
It is. I agree. But you also have big pharma.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, fills the void. They're always looking for new vaccines and drugs and the like, so there's money coming from there as well. There was none of that in the 1930s and 40s. The March of Dimes raised between 1945 and 1955, they raised almost $500 million, which, you know, today is LeBron James's salary, but in the 1950s was a ton of money.
Yeah.
They were taking so much of this of the charity dollar that they were resented in some parts, and they were willing to live with that.
Yeah. What do you think of, you know, sort of the newer philanthropic organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? And
they're fantastic. And the reason I love the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is that they've focused on polio.
Mm-hmm.
Polio eradication is their number one goal. They've already spent close to $1 billion and have offered another billion to end polio worldwide. The date is being pushed back again to final eradication by 2018. But I think once Bill and Melinda Gates become involved in something, things happen.
It's getting done.
They're just incredible. And they're incredible not just because they put their money where their mouth is. They're incredible because they have in place people from the public health sector and other sectors who really know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they have access to areas where polio is still endemic. So I really think it's possible that polio will be eradicated. And what is amazing, as you may know, is that only one infectious disease in the history of humankind has been wiped off the face of the earth, and that's smallpox. I'm not saying it's not in freezers and government military installations around the world, but there's no smallpox virus that is now circulating. And I think we have a chance by 2018 to make certain that polio is the second to be wiped off the face of the earth.
I want to turn to the relationship between Sabine and Saul. Sabin and Saul.
Right.
And I gather it wasn't exactly congenial.
No, they hated each other's guts.
And was that just a rivalry in terms of their vaccine types that they were trying to come up with, or was it personal?
It was a number of things. That certainly was the biggest. They had rival vaccines. They had rival constituencies in the virology community, one supporting a killed virus vaccine of Salk, the other the live virus vaccine of Sabin. I think most virologists saw Sabin as having what they considered to be the better vaccine, the live virus vaccine, thinking it gave a longer immunity, and being given through the mouth rather than injection was a bit easier, but it had big problems as well and was harder to develop. These guys also, both Jewish, both came from the New York City area, both attended the same medical school. Sometimes people who are very similar wind up despising each other more than people who are very different. And this, I think, was one of those cases.
Yeah, I think we get the idea that, you know, you scientist sits in his lab and he comes up with this great discovery, and, you know, it goes out there and it gets used, and it's, you know, pretty uncomplicated. But these are people who...
Both of whom were heavily funded by the March of Dimes, and the March of Dimes made them play nice. March of Dimes made them share information. If the March of Dimes had not done this, it would have been a very different situation. Yeah.
Can you tell us which of the stories of all these different scientists, all these different players, which one sticks out in your mind?
My favorite player in the book that I did is a woman named Isabel Morgan, this incredible researcher. Isabel Morgan, like most women researchers, scientific researchers in the 1930s and 40s, as a woman was denied serious funding, denied promotions, given the worst lab. And she was the Rockefeller Institute and finally decided, I've had enough of this, and went down to Johns Hopkins to join the polio unit. And while she was there, she began developing a killed virus vaccine that was quite good. It had problems, but it was quite good. And by my estimation, she was probably at least a year and a half ahead of Jonas Salk in the race for the killed virus vaccine. And then at the very height of her research powers, she did what women did in those days, and to some degree still have to do today, and she gave up her research career to marry, have a family. There was no sense at that time you could do both, and left science. The question is, had she stayed, would we be talking about the Morgan vaccine today and not the Salk vaccine? It's possible. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's possible. But what we can say is that Isabel Morgan blazed a trail that Jonas Salk took to completion. And one of the reasons, excuse me, I wrote this book was to show that it just wasn't Sabin and Salk, that there were dozens of brilliant, but until now completely anonymous researchers who put together the building blocks that made these vaccines possible. And they really deserve to be given credit for that. It's just not Salk, Sabin, Sabin, Salk.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that when a vaccine works, you know, nothing happens. And, you know, we talked about this kind of new phenomenon where parents are refusing vaccinating. And so sometimes I wonder whether the word eradication is kind of a dangerous word to use almost when it comes to diseases like polio, which are still very much alive and well, at least elsewhere. But I mean, you know, we are a very global society. People travel. And so I guess, you know, I was wondering when you wrote this book whether, you know, you were telling the story with, you know, the idea that medical students like us might kind of put it forward and remind ourselves and remind others about what polio looks like. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you did you have any hope that, you know, these images would kind of remain and, you know, the importance of vaccines and, you know, things like that would.
I think this book was written to some degree with the anti-vaccine movement in mind. Mm-hmm. The notion that there is no polio in the United States today because of vaccines. Mm-hmm. The vaccines have saved more lives of more people than any discovery in history. And that we now live in a world in which, at least in America, in which we believe, or some people believe, we don't need to vaccinate because A, there's really not much danger, which is ridiculous, or B, I'm going to be really selfish and let my kid live off herd immunity, mm-hmm. meaning that since, you know, 85-90% of the people are vaccinated, my kid is going to piggyback off that and not have to worry. Well, the problem is that that kid, unvaccinated, brings measles, brings whooping cough, and brings a whole slew of other diseases back into play. And it's very, very dangerous. And I think if there's one message from my polio book, it's keep vaccinating. You've got to keep vaccinating. If you don't keep vaccinating, polio is never going to go away. And indeed, it may come back. And if you vaccinate 400 million new kids every year and keep vaccinating, you will do away with polio and lots of other diseases.
So, Dr. Oshinsky, if you had your way, what would the new pro-vaccine campaign look like? You know, which celebrities would you choose to say, you know, we still have to vaccinate? What would that look like today?
Probably not Kim Kardashian.
What?
But, you know, that's just me talking. That's a very good question. I don't know which celebrities I would use, although a few have gotten involved in the movement. But what I can tell you is that we do need them. And here's the reason we do need them. What you get in these vaccine debates today are someone like Jenny McCarthy, who is very skilled at weaving a story about her, the problem her child had, which she blames on vaccination. And then you bring in a research scientist, and the moderator talks to them as if they both have the same level of expertise. Yeah. You know, we're going to give you both a chance. It's like, is the world flat? We're going to now talk to the flat earth person and give that person 50%. And then we're going to talk to the person who believes the world is round. And that's the way we're going to have our frame our debate. It's also true that it's very hard for research scientists to use statistics and facts and figures to talk on the one hand about polio while a bereaved mother is talking very personally and giving a story, a terrible story,
yeah.
about what vaccines allegedly did to her child, even though the evidence in the case of, say, polio and autism is overwhelming that there is no correlation. So I think what the media has to do is really to get serious about this. It has to understand exactly what's at stake and the expertise of those who are mouthing off about these vital issues. And the worst thing that could happen is that we learn the lesson of polio because we stop vaccinating to the point where polio comes back and begins devastating our children. And that is not, it's a remote possibility now, but it's there. And if we were to keep lowering the rate of vaccination, which is happening in the United States, we are heading back into those waters.
It's perhaps the other problem, sort of the difference between, you know, a researcher, a biomedical researcher's use of, you know, facts and figures and statistics and, you know, this kind of thing, which are fairly sometimes inaccessible to the public. And then you've got the emotional argument right. of the, you know, as you say, the bereaved mother. It's
an unfair fight.
Yeah, it really is. And I sometimes wonder if the researchers should, you know, bone up on, you know, emotional arguments. And I don't know if that's the right answer, but
well,
the message would maybe permeate better than
It's hard to say. I mean, I think that it's hard to use historical events and nail them down accurately, but certainly after Watergate and the Vietnam War, I think a lot of people lost faith in what experts told them,
right.
in what elites told them, and what the government told them. And I think the other factor that clearly came in is the internet. The internet makes everyone an expert, and you can just spin out there whatever you want to spin out there. And you're going to get an audience. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly one of the, for the anti-vaccine movement, it was one of the really big issues. Look, vaccines are not 100% safe, and they're not 100% effective. We all know that. There's risk to everything in life. But the polio vaccine, as an example, is about as safe as you'll ever get a vaccine to be, and incredibly effective. Mm.
So between Watergate and, you know, the rise of the internet expert, what, in your opinion, are some other things that have happened in this century that have led to where we are now?
Well, it's sort of a general question. Let me just end it this way. When I was a young boy in the 1950s, with all the vaccines coming into play and all the new antibiotics coming into play, we all believed, and American medicine believed, that infectious disease was going to be a thing of the past. We were going to wipe it off the face of the earth. Well, we have learned from SARS, AIDS, avian flu, that Mother Nature's always a step ahead of us, and we've got to keep the fight going. It's not a perfect fight, but try to think of a world in which we don't have antibiotics and we don't have vaccines. We've got to be careful. We've got to do serious research, but we've got to also understand that everything comes with risks and that vaccines, have been among the greatest lifesavers that we have. We're never going to be perfect. There's always going to be infectious disease. We're always going to be fighting it. But I think we've got to get serious about the consequences of doing less than we're doing now.
We've been talking today with David Oshinsky, PhD, whose book, Polio, An American Story, is available from Oxford University Press, and who came to us today thanks to the kind offer of Dr. Michael Welsh and the 2012 Distinguished Mentor Celebration Committee. Thank you very much for coming today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to The Short Code. The Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, you can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we're known as The Short Code. We also take comments and story ideas and the occasional rant from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. That's also where you can submit a question for our advice segment, The Short Couch. The executive producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our theme music is by Revolution Void from the album Increase the Dosage. Find them at www.revolutionvoid.com.